We're in Daniel chapter 8 tonight, so you can turn there with me at this time. Daniel chapter 8. It's been said that the teaching tool of repetition is the mother of all learning. Repetition. That is saying the same thing over and over again so that you finally will get it. And I know for my mind and my brain, that's the way it works. I have to hear something over and over again. The Lord oftentimes in His Word will employ repetition to ingrain those things in our minds that are really important. Whenever you see something in the Bible that's restated or a chapter that's identical to another chapter or even a verse that's identical to another verse, one thing you need to do is sit up, take notice, and say, okay, for some reason the Lord has seen fit to make us remember and put this in remembrance. In fact, in Paul's writing to young Timothy, and also we read in Peter, that there's this tool of repetition that it says a good pastor or a good minister will put the people in remembrance. And so sometimes there is a repetitious nature in the Bible, but it's all for a good cause. It's so that we might learn and understand the truth of what's being spoken. But also, sometimes repetition is also to show us maybe another nuance or perhaps another sense of what truth really is. It's kind of like Socrates. Maybe you've heard Socrates was this great philosopher, Greek, but he was also known for being very handsome and quite muscular, chiseled body and very impressive. And there was a young man that went up to Socrates and he said, Socrates, oh great Socrates, how can I attain wisdom? And he looked at the young man and says, do you really want wisdom? And the young man said, oh yes, Socrates, very, very much. And so Socrates said, then come with me. And so he brought the young man down into the river there, and they stood about waist deep in the water, and this powerful man, Socrates, just kind of held the man there by the neck, and they said, do you want wisdom? And he said, oh yes, great Socrates. And so he grabbed him and pushed him under the water and held him there for a while. He struggled, but finally let up. The guy came up out of the water and he said, do you really want wisdom? He said, oh, yes, great Socrates. Back down in the water and brought him back up. Do you really want wisdom? Yes. Held him under. And each time he held him under just a little longer and he started to struggle a little bit. And finally, Socrates pulled the guy up and he says, do you want wisdom? And he said, I want air. And Socrates says, you'll get wisdom when you want it as much as you wanted air just now. And he went out of the water. So a little lesson for the young man on wisdom. And really that repetition was to actually show something else, to give us more understanding. And in the same way, oftentimes, I have found the Bible does the same thing with repetition. We think we're learning something. Oh yeah, great. Okay, we got it. Then the Lord comes at it again, maybe from another angle. Oh yeah, Lord. Okay, got it. And then we do it again. Okay, Lord. And then we see maybe a nuance or something that we've missed in previous times through. In fact, I found that not only in the repetition of the Bible, but also in repetitious reading of the Bible. When you just read the same chapter, the same verses, and you read them over and over again, you'll find different nuances and different understanding. And by the time you're done, you realize, wow, I'm not even sure the first understanding I've had was even accurate. And the Lord has just kind of been showing me as we go through the Bible these repetitions that are so important. Well, in the same way, in Daniel chapter 8, we have the third go-round. The third go-round of what? Medes and the Persians and the Greeks. What? Well, remember in Daniel chapter 2, we saw those four parts of the statue representing Babylon, the Medes and the Persians, the Greeks led by Alexander the Great, and the Roman Empire, and then finally kind of that fifth empire that would come out of that old Roman Empire. We saw that in Daniel chapter 2 last Wednesday night. Daniel chapter 7. It was no longer these statue pieces or parts of the statue, but in Daniel chapter 7 we saw, first of all, this eagle wings on a lion representing Babylon. It was beasts. The first one was a lion with eagle's wings, and then the second one was a bear that had ribs in his mouth. And we saw the third was likened to a leopard. And the fourth beast was a terrible beast that we really received no real description of what it could be compared to. But it was just a terrible, brutal beast that we saw. And that fourth beast was similar to the Romans and then the empire that would come out. So really, it's the same exact prophecy. Now, we learned in our last go-around that that was God's perspective. The Daniel 2 was man's perspective, these great kingdoms, the Babylonians, the Romans, the Medes and the Persians, the Greeks. And then we saw God's perspective, that they weren't shiny golden statues, but in truth, they were just bloody beasts. And we saw them in Daniel 7 for what they really were. But here in Daniel chapter 8, we only take a look at these two kingdoms, two of the four. And we're going to see the specific mention of the Medes and the Persians, and then the Greeks led by Alexander the Great. Why, pray, is the Lord going to take a whole chapter of Daniel to have us look at these two kingdoms? Because you might even say, Brett, that's not even the ones we're really that interested in. Because we know that the kingdom that comes out of the old Roman Empire, that's the interesting stuff, Brett. That's where we start talking about modern day prophecy, stuff that's going to unfold even perhaps in our lifetime. And we get excited about that. Why then would the Lord have us focus on the Medes and the Persians and Alexander and the Greeks? What's the deal? Well, that's where, by going through it a few times, you're going to find that these two kingdoms have great significance. We're going to take a little closer look. We're going to put these kingdoms just even a little more under the microscope and say, what does it have to do with you? And what does it have to do with me? And you'll find that there really is an application and something that is of great importance. And so, this is a great thing. Repetition. See, the problem is with prophecy, one thing I've found is there are people that are kind of in three schools of prophecy. There's the group that they're the, that just believe, hey, it's all gonna pan out. I'm a millennialist. You know, it's just gonna pan out in the end. Whatever, the Bible gives us all this stuff about prophecy. Whatever, we don't need to study it. Sadly, a lot of churches, employ that as their posture for Bible prophecy. My challenge to that is, and people say, yeah, I like that, you know, why get so into prophecy? Brett, you're really into prophecy. Well, no, I'm into going through the Bible. 1/4 of the Bible is prophecy. So if you're a Bible student and you go through the Bible, you gotta do prophecy. That's part of the deal. But there, those people that say, oh, it'll just work out in the end. Let's not go to Daniel or the book of Revelation or Ezekiel or any of those things, because really, we'll just see what happens. The second reason I believe that's an error is because prophecy, well, there is a purpose behind prophecy. What is it, Brett? Is it to build bunkers under our house and store up Cheerios and guns? Well, sadly, there are some people, that's the point of prophecy to them. I think that's crazy. I think that's wacko. And I'll tell you why. Because honestly, if all this comes down as it says, your Cheerios aren't going to last very long, and your guns are going to be, well, they won't really protect you from what's coming. If you read about the Great Tribulation, you'll want more than a gun. You see, there's going to be all kinds of trouble and problems, but also, you know, the Bible says that he or she who has the hope of the Lord's return purifies himself. That's 1 John chapter 3, right around verses 5 and 6, talks about the studying of prophecy. One of the great benefits is you start to hope in the things of the Lord. You start looking forward to the future events, and it's something that's a good thing. By the way, if you're afraid of prophecy, like when we read some of this stuff and you get a quiver and you think, this is scary and creepy. Well, there's, you gotta remember, it's all good news for the Christian. But if you're a Christian, if you're one who's walked with the Lord and believe in Jesus as the Son of God who died on the cross and rose again, if you've confessed that and believe that in your heart, man, you're gonna be safe. The Lord's going to protect you. You have nothing to worry about. In fact, it's going to be nothing but good. Right now, right here, is as bad as it's going to get on earth. But man, once the rapture of the church takes place, once we're taken out of here, man, we've got nothing but heaven and glory in the future. That's going to be great. So hopefully you're not afraid. Hopefully you're not freaked out. Hopefully you don't take that first school of thought. Well, who cares about prophecy? It's all going to come out some way anyway. That's not a biblical view. The Lord tells us, be not ignorant of the things concerning end times. He tells us that several places in the Bible. The second view of prophecy is to get so radical into it, and it's the people that go hyper crazy and they do get the bunkers and the guns, and not really find what the purpose of prophecy is. What is the purpose of prophecy? Well, Revelation chapter 22 tells us that the spirit of prophecy is Jesus Christ. Man, I love that. It's all about Jesus Christ, focusing on the person of Jesus, the work of Jesus, and hopefully that's what we end up with as we study through the book of Daniel. Jesus Christ, looking to Him, looking to His return. But we're also going to see a benefit or something that we're to do at the end of this chapter when we get there. And I see some of you looking down. Don't look ahead. That's cheating. But let's go ahead and take a look at Daniel chapter 8 as we see this re-describing or another look at those two kingdoms, the Medes and the Persians, and of course the Greeks. Let's read. There in Daniel chapter 8, verse 1, it says, "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, the vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which was in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Ulai." Now pause here for a second. This is interesting. We're given sort of the time. It's the third year of the reign of Belshazzar. Now, go back to chapter 7, verse 1. It was in the first year of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon. So you see that in verse 1 of chapter 7. So the vision that we read about last week was given to Daniel when he was about 67 years old. The chronological order of Daniel is a little shuffled there toward the end. The first several chapters we kind of saw a chronological order. Now we're sort of bouncing around. But chapter 7 lies somewhere between chapter 4 and 5, chronologically speaking. But so does chapter 8, as it is in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, where he gets this vision. So question, and I think this is important. Who is in power in that region of the world? Is of all these nations we've been talking about, whose kingdom is still up and running right now? Babylon, that's right. And how do we know that? Well, Belshazzar was a Babylonian ruler, right? And so that's important to understand that this chapter was given to Daniel in a vision during the reign of a Babylonian king. In other words, it was before the Medes and the Persians ever came onto the scene. Now you say, Brett, that seems kind of like a no-brainer. Well, tell that to all the so-called, critics of the Bible. Because they're the ones who freak out at a chapter like Daniel chapter 8. It's one of the really very controversial books of the Bible, Daniel, but also Daniel chapter 8 is one of the peaks of criticism. Why? Well, not because of its content. The content is spot on accurate historically. But that's what creates a problem. We look backward through history and we say, wow, Daniel chapter 8 has been fulfilled. But the critics say it's impossible for Daniel to have penned those words right there during, the 330s BC, somewhere in there. It's impossible. How could Daniel have known that there would come the Medes and the Persians, then the Greeks led by Alexander the Great and his four generals coming up after him? How would Daniel have ever known that? And really, one word answers that. God. Daniel knew because God told him in a vision. And this is the third time we're seeing this vision, but we're only going to see even greater detail in Daniel chapter 8. I love this about the Bible. This is what freaks out the critics. And this is why they say, oh, Daniel's a forgery. Somebody really wrote the book of Daniel. It had to be somewhere around AD 50 or AD 90, they say. Which always cracks me up because we know the Septuagint, which included the Greek translation of the Old Testament book of Daniel. And it dates way back to several hundred years before Christ came, which is not that far off from when Alexander came and when the Medes and the Persians. In fact, before Alexander the Great came, we have proof that this book, Daniel, was there in the ancient scrolls of the Old Testament. The scholars that are critics of the Bible, so-called scholars, I should say, they are wrong on this one. The book of Daniel is a book of prophecy. The Bible tells us in the Psalms that the Lord is the one who's able to tell the beginning from the end. God is the only one who can really tell us the future. And that's one of the fun things about being a Bible student. You and I have a little sneak preview of coming attractions, not only as did Daniel, seeing in his lifetime some of those things starting to unfold, those kingdoms coming. But we look backward now and say, wow, all those prophecies came true from Daniel chapter 8. But here's the exciting thing. Next week in Daniel chapter 9, we're going to see prophecies that have unfolded and been fulfilled, but also huge prophecies that are unfolding right now. Things that we are beginning to see happening that have yet to happen that the Bible has predicted thousands of years ago. How does the Bible do it? It's God. God knows the beginning from the end. Bible prophecy is one of the great proofs, in my opinion, that this Bible that we hold is God's inspired word. Man, that's important. I can't believe even Christian pastors are starting to say, well, we can't be sure that this book that we hold is the inspired word of God. These pastors haven't been reading the Bible or something. They're not seeing it because these prophecies are profound and only God could have done the work of the book of Daniel. Well, we see that and it begins right here in verse 2. As we read in verse 2, it says, I saw in a vision and there was two things mentioned there that I find interesting. He was in Shushan in the place which is in the province of Elam. And I saw a vision, and I was by the river Ulai. Now, what's the big deal about that? Why is that important? Well, during the reign of the Babylonian kings, when this was seen in Daniel's vision, Shushan was really nothing. It was a city, but it didn't have any importance. And this river, which is actually kind of a built canal called Ulai, it also had no real significance during this time when Daniel wrote this. However, it was not long after the Medes and the Persians came and subdued the Babylonian Empire that they moved that palace of the king from Babylon to Shushan. It would be the Persians who would rule from Shushan. And that maybe rings a bell if you've read the Bible before. Because if you remember, about 100 years later, there was the Persian king, Xerxes, ruling from Shushan, and it was right around the story of the book of Esther. And so Daniel seeing Shushan, man-made canal, Ulai, that would actually be Persian. These are Persian descriptions, which hasn't even happened yet. Daniel saying, I was in Shushan by this canal called, or river called, the Ulai, and man, that's already getting into prophecy right there. The Babylonians really didn't have a palace like that in Shushan, but that's what this is about. It's going to be about the Medes and the Persians. And so the setting starts off right in the Persian Empire, if you would. He's seeing this great vision. Well, verse 3, then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram, which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher came up last. Now, this is kind of a strange description of a ram. So there's a ram, no big deal, that's a ram, with two horns, still no big deal. But now we get into the weird thing when we've got one horn bigger than the other horn, but it also gives us some more detail about that. This ram has two horns, the ones, they were both high, but one was higher than the other, but the higher came up last. So the bigger of the horns came up last, which is a description of the Medes and the Persians. Brett, how do you know? You're making this stuff up. Well, wait, it's tempting just to read the whole chapter because then you'd go, oh yeah, okay, whatever, it's the Bible. But let's jump ahead just for a second. I want to show you just so you're not doubting me the whole time. Check it out, verse 20. Verse 20 of chapter 8, Daniel 8, verse 20. The ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. And just for future reference, verse 21. And the rough goat is the king of Greece. And his great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Okay, so now I've already given you the punchline. So we've got the rams versus the goats, and we're not talking NFL here. This is some kingdoms of ancient times, and this first kingdom we know from verse 20 is the Medes and the Persians, and that's exactly how it happened. There were two horns, the Medes and the Persians. One came up stronger at first, which was the Median Empire. The Medes were powerful, and they did most of the conquering. But it would be the Persian Empire that would come up stronger than the Medes after the Medes kind of finished subduing most of the nations in that region. The Persians would come in, and Cyrus and the Persians and those guys would come in and pretty much be stronger. And really it became really just the Persian Empire. And that's what happened. So you got these two horns, the Medes and the Persians. The Medes start out stronger, then the Persians come up exactly like it happened. But it gets even more, more clear and descript as it talks about the Medes and the Persians. Verse 4. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beasts might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. Now the detail given here I find just really exciting. I'll tell you why. When you study the Medo-Persian Empire and how they conquered that region of the world, they did it exactly like the Bible says. You say, what do you mean? I don't see that much detail. But did you notice the directions given there in verse 4? I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward. Normally, you kind of see stuff north, south, east, and west. Or at least you see some kind of order of the circular compass. But here, we kind of see this westward, northward, and then southward. And what about eastward? Well, the Medo-Persian Empire didn't push eastward. They only pushed north, south, and west. But if you study the way they did it in this exact order. They didn't only just leave out the east, but they started out going westward. And then after they conquered and subdued those nations of the west, then they pushed northward and then southward after that. And that's exactly how this came down. You see, Daniel is getting some exacting descriptions, stuff we've not seen in Daniel chapter 7 and also in Daniel chapter 2. Now we're getting some nitty-gritty detail about the Medo-Persian Empire. If you want to study that, check out the battles of Medo-Persian Empire and how they subdued that part of the world. It's just like Daniel sees in this vision, perfectly unfolding. And so it continues there in verse 5. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes, and he came to ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in a fury of his power. Okay, so now we got this battle. Now, normally you say, Brett, a goat taking on a ram. Now, you know in the cartoons when the goats come up and give the old headbutt and knocks the person? I've had that happen to me. You know, I remember when one time, we didn't have goats, we had sheep and stuff. Well, sheep were a little nicer than goats, but goats will eat anything. It's kind of fun to watch them eat, you know, dirt and cans and barbed wire and stuff. Goats are amazing. They'll eat anything. But goats are also kind of ill-tempered a lot of times. And I remember one time I was feeding the neighbor's animals while they were on vacation. I was over there just kind of dumping some grain. And I remember bending over to do something. And sure enough, their old he-goat came and wham, right in my rear and knocked me down. You know, there's cow pies, everything, all that down the ground. It was a real bummer. These goats, they're pretty powerful. But compared to a ram, rams are powerful. And so what do we got here? We've got this little goat coming, but it seems mighty. And there's a description here that I find intriguing. It is a description of the Grecian Empire led by Alexander the Great. Note with me some of its attributes. Notice it came from the west on the face of the whole earth. That's exactly what Alexander the did. He came and subdued all the nations as he moved from the west toward the east. The Greek there, Alexander, came toward this Medo-Persian Empire and he moved with great speed. See, when the Greeks attacked, when Alexander the Great attacked the Medo-Persian Empire, he had an army of 35,000 men. You say, wow, that's a big army. No, it was tiny. For those days in that time, the Medo-Persian Empire had more than 1 million foot soldiers. So can you imagine 1 million foot soldiers versus 35,000? But this army of Alexander, he was able to move it with great speed. The idiom here that's used, it says, and he touched not the ground. That's a Hebrew idiom used by the Jews. You see that in Jewish writings and in the Bible. He did not touch the ground means that he moved with great rapidity or speed. And that's exactly what Alexander, he was able to move with great speed. You see, Alexander, when you study some of his war tactics, it really is pretty brilliant. Now, he invented a lot of things. In fact, sometimes the Romans get credit for some of the things, the battle tactics that Alexander used. But really, Alexander the Great was was thought to be a god by many of the Greeks. He too, like Socrates, was very physically in shape, kind of like Jeff Young, you know, chiseled and everything. And this guy, Alexander the Great, he was known for being just totally ripped and stuff, but he was also very, very smart. He was known for his battle tactics. Like, for example, in ancient warfare, you always attacked with the sun to your backs. And the reason you do that is it's just better to not have the sun in your eyes when you're charging toward the enemy. You want the sun in their eyes. So it was pretty normal for you to attack from the direction, whatever, wherever the sun was. And Alexander the Great turned that around and he started to always attack toward the sun with the sun in his soldiers' eyes. So oftentimes the Medes and the Persians, they didn't even know where these guys were coming from. Why would they attack from the direction of the sun? Well, Alexander was the one who invented the way of warfare where he would take the men's shields and they would shine them to be perfectly polished. Really, really polished. And then holding their shields as they would charge, and by the way, he invented the flying wedge too, you football players, you know what that is. The Greeks, they had the flying wedge, sometimes two men deep. And they would start charging the army with the sun in their eyes, and then they would hold up their shields where the sun was beaming off the shields, but not in their enemy's eyes yet. They would hold them up, they would charge, but then right when they'd get almost within hand-to-hand combat range, they would move their shields down, and they would blind their enemies with their shields with the sun, and the enemies didn't oftentimes know what hit them. They couldn't see a thing, and they were quickly slain and batted down like flies. Alexander used tactics like that with his ragtag little group of 35,000, but they were actually sort of Green Beret soldiers, if you will. They were the special forces. And that's how they subdued these Medo-Persian Empire. Now, this is important. Why? One thing that's been congruent throughout each one of these prophecies from Daniel 2, Daniel 7, and Daniel 8 is this decreasing level of greatness within these kingdoms. Now, that's important. I'll tell you why. I haven't really addressed this yet. You see, remember in the gold statue of Daniel 2, there was the gold, silver, brass, iron, and then iron mixed with clay, the final kingdom. And that was a decreasing, descending order of those metals. At the same time, each one of those governments were descending in order. If you'll remember, the Babylonians were an absolute monarchy. You know, the king could say, off with your head, and you were dead. But then it went descending from there. The Medo-Persian Empire was a constitutional monarchy, and it was where they had to sign laws, and the king even had to abide by those laws. And then each one of those things descended. There was this descending order of nations in power, in prowess, and yet, the lesser nation would come and subdue and destroy the greater nation. And we see that here. We've got the big, powerful ram with two big horns, and this little goat comes skipping up, and what's he gonna do? He's gonna mess up the ram. How's that gonna happen? Well, it's part of God's description of what's gonna happen. Each one of these nations would come and they'd be decreasing, less impressive. Why is that important to us? Well, in Daniel 8, we don't really have the fulfillment of these nations. We're only gonna look at those two nations, but if you remember in the other prophecies, it went from the Babylonians, Medo-Persian Empire, Greeks, Romans, and then some kind of a modern nation in the last days. Remember the 10 toes? Feet mixed with iron and clay, or the 10 horns we saw last week coming out of the beast in the last days. There's gonna be 10 nations, and it's gonna be a mixed up 10 nation confederation. Mixture of iron and clay. And did you ever notice, have you ever tried to mix up iron and clay together? It doesn't work so well. They don't mingle. They don't mix. What's the point? Well, the final kingdom that's gonna happen in the last days will be a fairly weak nation. It will not look like the Babylonian Empire in its greatness, or the Medo-Persian, or the Greeks, or even the Romans. It's going to look like a kind of a weak, strange little nation. But it's going to come, and the coming world leader, which we will talk about tonight, Lord willing, will lead this group, and it will cause trouble. Even though it'll be small and sort of maybe... One of the things we can look for is this group of 10 nations sort of being blown off as, oh, whatever, these people, what kind of power do they have? That's something we should probably look for. That's why we see this decreasing level in these kingdoms. So we got the ram with the two big horns. Now we got this goat coming up. And notice a few other attributes of this goat, that not only was he not touching the ground, which means he was speedy, not only that he came from the west and on the face of the whole earth. What did the Greeks do by the leadership of Alexander? Dominated the world. Alexander the Great was the one who fell down in his bed weeping, saying, "I have no more worlds to conquer." In fact, there's history that writes about Alexander when he finally did subdue the world. He had this big meeting with some of his generals, and they argued for hours and hours and hours about, really? There's no other worlds to conquer? There's nobody we can take on now? No opponents? And Alexander would not believe his generals when they said, nope, there's nobody left. And that's when he got really depressed. And I believe that led to his own demise, where he died right at the age of 33 or thereabouts. And so that's the situation here. He's got this he-goat with a notable horn between his eyes. And look at verse 6. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran into him in the fury of his power. So he's a furious goat. Now, it says in verse 7, and I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler or anger against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore, the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Okay, now before we get into this final description of the goat here, keep in mind that the goat actually was a symbol of Greece, as was, by the way, the ram. You know, one of the things we have to be careful of is ascribing these animals and stuff to the nations and making too much out of that. But there are some interesting historical comparisons. Hopefully you're not into astrology, as it's a fairly godless institution. But one of the things, when you study about the history of astrology, there's some interesting findings. There are some who would argue that those astrological signs of the zodiac actually do have some biblical background. Now, I'm not saying that it's a right thing to do, and I do believe it's just a demonic and devilish thing that some innocent people think it's okay. It's just, hey, we're just goofing around with the stars. Be careful. It's got backgrounds in real dark black stuff. But at the same time, one of the things about the signs of the zodiac, when you look at these ancient nations, those signs that they would ascribe to the Greeks was the goat and the ram. And there's some interesting parallels there. There's another thing that they found in Israel that has caused scholars and historians just total confusion. And that is, they found a first century synagogue, which was right around the time of Christ. And this first century synagogue, there was this mosaic they found in the floor. And in the floor, when they uncovered it, they found in the mosaic, in this beautiful depiction of the zodiac, of the stars and the astrological signs, right there in a Hebrew synagogue, which is kind of an interesting deal. And so we kind of wonder if we don't really know much about the ancient history of that. But all that's to say, there are some linkages here to these symbols that we're talking about, the ram, the Medes and the Persians, and the goat. And you can find those links in history, let alone right here in the Bible, which is really what only really what matters, the Bible. But just interesting stuff. Now notice what happens. This goat, after it pummels the two horns off the ram's head, then notice what happens. The goat waxes great, and when he was strong, so right at the pinnacle of his strength, which is exactly what happened, as Alexander the Great conquered the world, he conquered the world. In fact, by the age of 21, the Greeks said he was the greatest military genius that ever lived. By the age of 33, he's going to die at a young age. And that's kind of the depiction we're given here, as it says, while he was very strong and great, the great horn, Alexander, was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Now, question. Let's see how well you were listening last week. What do you think these four horns that came up in the place of the single horn, what do you think these four horns are?
Generals,
man, you guys are smart. This is awesome. Man, this is good. Now you say, if you're, well, I wasn't here last week, so I don't really know. Well, flip back a page to chapter 7, just real quick. When we were talking about the Greeks last week, it was described as a leopard in verse 6. There it says in chapter 7 of Daniel, verse 6, after this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which implies speed, like the Greeks of there of chapter 8, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl, and the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. So it's the same description. There was these four heads that came out of the leopard. But here in chapter 8, we see these four horns that are raising up now. Okay, so you still with me? Those are the four generals, and if you wrote them down last week, or if you missed that, you can pick up the CD or the MP3. But Cassander was a general that took over, Alexander's four generals. He took over Europe, and Lysimachus took over Asia Minor, and Ptolemy, starting with a P there, Ptolemy took over Egypt, and Seleucus took over Babylon, Asia, and Syria. So that was the Grecian Empire divided into four. As I mentioned last week, Alexander the Great, one of the things historians tell us as he was lying, dying, and they were saying, well, who would get the kingdom? He said, give the kingdom to the strong. And then he died. That's kind of funny because, like I said, man, I think that must have been a tough staff meeting next morning. Okay, so who does the kingdom go to? Alexander's dead. The strong. I'm strong. Well, those four generals, what they decided to do is divide up the kingdom to those four strong generals, which would, for the next several hundred years, cause huge problems in that region of the world. There's going to be giant turmoil. In fact, keep all this tucked in the back of your head. And the reason why is in Daniel chapter 11. We're going to see these generals of the four. We're going to look under the microscope even further at two, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. We're going to look at those, and they're talked about in great detail in Daniel chapter 11. So we'll get into all that later. But let's consider the four now. So these four generals come up, four horns out of the Grecian Empire. And so what does it do? It says, after that, verse 9, out of one of them, out of one of what? Out of one of those four horns came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. Now here's where controversy stirs. Daniel chapter 7, we saw a little horn, and he was very clearly depicted as being this coming world leader that would be in the last days, and we described him as the Antichrist. And it's pretty clear to me and to many others, I think, that was the Antichrist. So now you must assume, right? Chapter 8, the little horn, same thing, right? Well, it's a hard way to answer it, but I'm going to say yes and no. I don't know about this, Brett. You're a double-minded man, unstable in all your ways. Well, wait a minute. You see, here in chapter 8, this is describing a different person. And you say, well, Brett, well, what does this have to do? Then why is it called a little horn? Well, first of all, you have to understand the horn was a symbol of authority, power, and might. It's a symbol we don't really talk about much anymore, unless you're in rodeo or something when you've been skewered by one of the bull horns. That becomes very powerful to you. But today, we kind of don't think about horns, but it was a big thing back then. So this idea of a little horn, common theme. But I don't believe this is speaking of the Antichrist, that coming world leader, as some very good Bible teachers and scholars would even say, oh yes, this is the little horn. I think this is not the little horn, and I'll show you why. But don't be mad at me yet if you're saying, I think it's a little horn. There's a little bit to say at the end here. So this little horn, verse 9, comes out of one of the four, which waxed, verse 9, exceeding great toward the south, and toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. So what happened? Well, in history, something happened that very much follows this to a T. In fact, as I describe the next several verses to you, we're going to see this very specifically speaks of an interesting world dominator or leader that came on the scene during this time. His name, Antiochus Epiphanes. Some people say Antiochus or Epimanes. There's different ways people pronounce them. But he's Antiochus the Fourth, and he was the Seleucid ruler, or the king that came along out of the four generals of Alexander the Great. He was a godless, bloody, brutal leader. And notice the description. He's a little horn which waxed exceeding great toward the south, which is exactly what he did. The first thing this leader, Antiochus Epiphanes, did is he went down toward the south to fight against the Ptolemies who took over Egypt, and he dominated Egypt and actually lived there for quite some time. This world leader, Antiochus Epiphanes. And he goes down into Egypt toward the south, then he went toward the east, and then he went toward, verse 9 at the end, the pleasant land. Now, when you read that phrase in the Bible, what is the pleasant land? Jerusalem and Israel specifically. So why, pray, did this leader, Antiochus Epiphanes, go that way? By the way, if you want to read some interesting stuff on this, in the Apocrypha, which I don't believe is the inspired Word of God, but the Apocrypha, there's some very helpful historic writings given to us. In 1 Maccabees chapter 1, that whole chapter describes in really great and historically accurate detail this leader, Antiochus Epiphanes, and you can read it and you'll learn a lot from that. We'll get into maybe some of those things as we continue. So what does this guy do? He goes toward the pleasant land. Why? Well, after he took over Egypt and lived there, a new group that was rising in power was a little group called the Romans. And he was down there in Egypt, and the Romans kind of came and drove him out. So he went back up north and decided to build himself a buffer between the Romans down in the south and then the land of Israel would be his buffer zone. So he centers himself in Jerusalem. And that's what this man does. So what does he do? Well, he does that. He waxes great. Verse 10, even to the host of heaven, and it casts down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped on them. Now there's debate on what the stars and the hosts of heaven are that he did. Some would say he was stamping out the Lord and trying to put down the Lord. Others would say he's talking about the Jews, for even in Daniel chapter 12, the Jews are kind of referred to as stars. But he's going to do that. He's going to stamp down the Jewish people when he comes to make Jerusalem his empire headquarters. And so it says in verse 11, he magnified, yea, himself, even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by the reason of transgression or sin, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Wow. This is a very interesting description, and man, I wish we could go into some of the words here that are quite colorful. The word practice there has its origin in black magic, kind of like practicing witchcraft. This guy was into dark stuff, and even sort of magical stuff historically we read. But also when it says there in verse 12, he cast down the truth to the ground. The book of 1 Maccabees, which is of the Apocrypha, describes how he took the law of the Jews, the scrolls of the Old Testament Pentateuch, and he threw them down into the fire and burned any copy he could find of the scrolls of the Jews. This all happened in history. This is stuff Daniel's seeing, a vision into the future, seeing all this stuff come down. This guy did all kinds of crazy things. He forced Jews to eat pig meat. Why? Well, that wasn't a very kosher thing for a Jew to do. But he was trying to grind them down to the ground, make the Jews not keep the law, and to do all kinds of abominations against the Lord. That's what this guy's goal was. But then he caused the sacrifice system in Jerusalem to cease. How did he do that? Well, he killed many of the priests, but the high priest of Jerusalem at that time was taken out onto the steps of the temple there in Jerusalem. And Antiochus Epiphanes said, you will drink this pig's blood before all these people or die. And the high priest there in Jerusalem said, I will not drink this pig's blood. And so they slew him there on the steps of the temple in Jerusalem. And then Antiochus Epiphanes went on a rampage. Some historians tell us that he killed up to 1 million Jews during that time period. Pretty radical. Isn't it amazing how the Jews always somehow become a target of some crazy man? Whether it's Pharaoh in Egypt killing the babies, the Jewish people. Whether it's, you know, Haman there and Esther who was trying to kill off all the Jews and make them become extinct. The book of Esther. Or here, Antiochus Epiphanes or Hitler. Or others who have come and gone throughout history that have tried to wipe out the Jews. Man, if you don't believe they're still God's chosen people, then, man, you haven't really looked at your history. Because God's chosen people is like the Jewish old man said, hey, why doesn't the Lord choose someone else for a while? Because, man, it's tough being God's chosen people. And that's true even for us. Sometimes you'll find yourself not, we haven't tasted even a hint of what the Jews have over the centuries, but the Bible says those who live godly in Christ will suffer. Well, such was the case for the Jewish people, man. They suffered brutally. Antiochus Epiphanes making this high priest drink blood on the steps and then murdering, killing tens of thousands, even up to 1 million Jews there in Jerusalem at that time. Now, interesting thing, by the way, his name, Antiochus, one of the things he liked to call himself was Antiochus Theos Epiphanes the Fourth, which means he was claiming to be God by saying Antiochus Theos or God. Epimanes or Epiphanes? Well, Epiphanes means magnified or glorifying of himself. That's what he wanted to do, the magnified one. So he's saying, I am Antiochus, God, the magnified one. That's quite a name he gave himself. But the Jews, historically, we read that they actually did a little play on words. Instead of saying Antiochus Epiphanes, they changed the spelling oftentimes, or in the way they pronounced it. It wasn't Antiochus Epiphanes, it was Antiochus Epimanes, which doesn't mean the magnified one, it means the madman. And the Jews would call him Antiochus Epimanes because they said he was a mad, crazy man. That's really the truth. That's what was coming down. So he did all these crazy things there. Casting down the sanctuary, taking away the worship and the sacrifice daily in the temple, and burning the law of the Lord there. And now Daniel hears something. It says in verse 13, then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, mark that, transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot. And he said unto me, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now here's where people get really turned around and debate this, and when is this happening, or is it going to be in the future? I believe, and I'll show you why here a little later, why this is speaking specifically of the story of Antiochus Epiphanes. I want to show you, first of all, there's some confusion because when it says here 2,300 days, that's the period of time that the sanctuary sacrifice would be removed according to this angel or this voice that came, the saint that came and spoke to Daniel according to verse 13. He says, how long is this going to happen? See, Daniel's concerned because we kind of go, so the temple's all messed up. That's a bummer. But to Daniel, that was everything. You start taking away the sacrifice out of the temple, that means the sin of the people is unforgiven. That's a problem for a Jew in those times. And Antiochus, when he killed the high priest, he took out the worship of God and the sacrifice system, and he put in idols and even set himself up to be magnified as God. That's what Antiochus Epiphanes did. And so Daniel says, oh man, how long is this going to be? And so he tells him 2,300 days. Now, many of your margins say concerning this 2,300 days, it says there evenings and mornings, or mornings and evenings, depending on which Bible you have. Do you see that? Does some of yours say that? Yeah. So why does it say that? Well, there's confusion. Is it days or is it 2,300 mornings and evenings? Well, it's kind of an interesting debate. But all that's to say is the sacrifice was done in the morning and the evening. And those morning and evening sacrifices were removed for how long? Well, it would seem 2,300 days. Now, from the time that the high priest of Jerusalem was slain there on the temple steps, you can jot these dates down if you wish, in 171 BC, September 6th, that's when Antiochus tried to make the high priest drink the pig's blood. And if you calculate from that day where he did that and set up the temple to not be a place of worship of God, but a place to be worshiping all other pagan gods, that was 171 BC, September 6th. If you move forward, that brings you to another date that was very, very key. For later on, that high priest who was killed there, he had five sons. And those five sons came along, which was almost 6 years later, and he ended up wiping out or driving out Antiochus Epiphanes. And that date brings us to December 25th, 165 BC. So what happened on that day? That was something that many of you might be familiar with, the Maccabean Revolt. You know, the Festival of Lights and the story of Hanukkah. Have you heard that? Well, a lot of people say Hanukkah. Isn't that what the Jews celebrate around Christmas time? Well, yes. And it's about this story. And we'll probably go into that story a little bit later. But what's Hanukkah have to do with this? Oh man, it's an amazing story. I wish I could tell you. But basically, just in a nutshell, it was that time where the Maccabean Revolt, the sons of the high priest came and drove out Antiochus. And that's how long the sacrifice ceased. They had to cleanse the temple because of all the pig's blood and all the junk that had been done in the temple. They had to do their Jewish cleansing rites, and they did that, except somebody forgot to get the oil for the temple. And the lights were lit. And once you lit the lights or the lamps in the temple, they were not to go out, and they were to remain continually on, or else the temple wouldn't be cleansed. So they, what are we going to do? The lights have been lit. We don't have any oil. It's going to run out before the 8 days or whatever. And so they started to pray. And there, as the story goes, the candles remained lit with no oil burning, but they just kept burning miraculously. And the temple was cleansed. And that's the Festival of Lights. That's where that all came from this Antiochus Epiphanes, the Maccabean Revolt. And that's where the Apocrypha book kind of tells us about that in 1 Maccabees chapter 1 and chapter 2. You say, Brett, enough history. Well, I'm not quite done yet. Here we go. So don't be confused. It's all hopefully going to come together here toward the end. So that's that 2,300 days for the temple or the sanctuary to be cleansed. Verse 15, and it came to pass when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as appeared the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice, which was between the banks of the Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. Now, this is the first time we hear about Gabriel. Gabriel's the angel that's often called the messenger angel. Kind of interesting. So Gabriel's coming on the scene. We're going to also see him in Daniel chapter 9 and other places in the Bible. Verse 17, so he came near to me where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Okay, Brett, now I'm confused. At the time of the end? Are we talking about the last days, or are we talking about history there? 171 BC. Where are we? Well, see, that's where people debate. Is it at the end of the time of the Maccabean Revolt? At the end of the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes? Or is it at the end of all time in the future? And that's where a lot of confusion stirs. Let's keep reading verse 18. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright. Apparently, he fainted. You say he's sleeping now? Is he kind of bored? I am. I can understand why Daniel's asleep here. All this stuff about it. Wait a minute. No, he probably fainted. He probably fainted. And so this angel touches him and sets him back up. Verse 19, and he said, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed, the end shall be. And so again, people say, well, wait a minute, the indignation, that's a word that's used against the Jews in other places of the Bible. The wrath of God against Jews. So then the people argue, well, is it the wrath that Antiochus had, the indignation that he had toward the Jews? Or is it the time described in the book of Revelation when the indignation or the time of the wrath of the Lamb will be poured out upon the world? And so there's debate. What's this talking about? But Brett, you said all this stuff already happened historically. It did. So is it the end of times? Well, I'll keep reading. Verse 20. The ram which thou saw having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. And the rough goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the one nation. But not in his power, which is exactly what happened, right? Alexander died, and then those four kings came up having nothing to do with really Alexander's power. Verse 23, and in the latter time of their kingdom. Now that's where I think it gives us more specific description. At the last time or the latter time, which is another thing you think, latter days, Brett, the word latter there, that's a key word, right? We're talking about end times. But it says at the latter time of their time. So whose time? Those four generals, those four kings. What's going to happen? At the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. And verse 24, his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. So we're talking now, I believe, of Antiochus Epiphanes, how he'd come up and he would be not of his own power. Question, where does he probably get his power from? Satan, right? It makes sense. As he practiced and prospered, as it says there. And he shall destroy wonderfully. Now the King James says wonderfully. You're thinking, oh, how lovely he destroyed. But that's not what's going on. The idea is terribly, awesomely destroyed. And shall prosper and practice and shall destroy the mighty and the holy place, which is the Jerusalem, and the temple itself. Verse 25. And through his policy also shall he cause craft to prosper. Again, that's probably speaking of witchcraft in his hand. And he shall magnify himself in his heart, which is a very devilish kind of thing to do, isn't it? Pride. And by peace shall destroy many. Now, the idea is peace or prosperity. It's going to be kind of a sort of a fake peace. That's exactly, by the way, what Antiochus said. If you stop worshiping the God of the Jews, and Jews, we're going to burn your scrolls, we're going to destroy your temple, but if you follow my way and worship me as Antiochus Theos Epiphanes the Fourth, then you'll live in peace and you'll prosper. That was his tactic. But he shall also stand up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken without hand. In other words, How did Antiochus eventually die? Well, he died of a very sick, foul disease. And I could go into those details, but I'm not going to gross you out. But he stood up against the prince of princes. Brett, this sounds to me like the Antichrist. But wait, we're still talking about in the latter days of their kingdom. That is the Greeks and those four generals. So how does this work out? Well, see, right now, all of it fits Antiochus Epiphanes to the T. Even going against the prince of princes, because why? He's going against God's people, against the temple sacrificial system. It all fits. But he will be broken without hands, speaking of God taking him out. Verse 26, and the vision of the evening and the morning, which was told, is true. Wherefore, shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick. You're saying, Brett, that's us. Please let us go. But wait. There's just a few things we need to cover here. Now you say, okay, Brett, so you're saying this is Antiochus Epiphanes of the history. But man, it sure sounds like the Antichrist. Well, see, that is really accurate. That's why I say yes and no. I think that Bible teachers that say this is the Antichrist, I think is a mistake. But this is just a foreshadow, or perhaps you could even talk about Some Bible prophecy teachers talk about a dual fulfillment of prophecy. That's something that we've seen a lot in the Bible. There are several places in Jeremiah, Ezekiel, even Isaiah, and also here in Daniel where we see dual fulfillments. It's almost like the Lord gives a vision to God's man and he sees it, but then his gaze goes even further out still and sees sort of a dual fulfillment of that same prophecy. I believe Daniel chapter 8 is speaking of the Medo-Persian Empire being trounced by the Greeks. Four generals come up. A leader out of those four generals comes and does all the things that are very similar to what the Bible describes in both the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation, the Antichrist, the future world ruler that is coming, that is predicted will do. And it's a foreshadow of those coming attractions. If you're taking notes, just jot down a few of those things with me. Notice with me number one. He will achieve great power by subduing other nations. We see that in verse 24. It says that his power shall be mighty, he shall destroy and shall prosper. The idea is that's what he's going to do. He's going to subdue nations. And that's in verse 24. That's exactly what the Bible says Antichrist will do. Number two, comparison between the little horn of Daniel 8 and the little horn of Daniel 7. Verse 2, he will rise to power by promising false peace. False peace. You see, the Bible tells us in Daniel chapter 9, he's going to sign a covenant and a treaty in that region of the world, sort of a peace treaty. It's kind of like what we see in Israel all the time, people trying to sign accords and treaties and what have you, but nobody's been able to do it. But the future world leader that the Bible describes as Antichrist will come up with this fake peace. And the world will say, oh, peace, peace, but it's not going to happen. It's a pseudo peace. And we see that in verse 25 where it says, and by peace he shall destroy many. That's a very Antichrist kind of thing. Also, number three, he will be intelligent and persuasive. Verse 23 gives us that. In the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full end, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. The idea is he will be a man that will seem really wise, understanding things that nobody else gets or understands. It's been said of this coming world leader, and we'll see bits and pieces of this as we go through the rest of Daniel, but the world leader in the future, Antichrist, will have charisma. He will have political prowess and power. He will be seemingly peaceful and kind. You see, we always picture Antichrist as this sinister little fellow running around with a Vincent Price type voice. But not so. He's going to be slick. He's going to have probably the nice jovial personality of a Ronald Reagan. He'll have the foreign policy of a Richard Nixon. He might have the savvy of Ike Eisenhower or different presidents in the past that we go, oh, that was a great man. This guy will be the summary or the summation of all those different personalities. He's going to be slick. But that's the case here with this guy. He's going to have intelligence and persuasiveness. Number four, he will be controlled by another. Controlled by another. Verse 24 tells us that, but not by his own power. He's by the power of Satan. That's exactly what the Antichrist will be. Number five, he will be an adversary of Israel and subjugate Israel to his authority. Just like Antiochus did here, as we see there in verses 24 and 25, where it says that he will go against the people, the holy people, at the end of verse 24. And also, through his policies shall cause craft to prosper, and he will magnify himself and destroy the people and stand up against the prince of princes. All of that is what the Antichrist is going to do. He's going to be an adversary of Israel and subjugate them to his authority. Number six, he will rise up in opposition to the prince of princes, which is the Lord Jesus Christ. And that's exactly what's going to happen. As verse 25 tells us, he's going to go against the prince of princes. The book of Revelation tells us that he will set his weaponry toward Jesus. When Christ returns, his second coming, with 10,000s of his saints, that's what Antichrist will do, only he's going to lose. And that's told to us in the book of Revelation. Finally, number seven, his rule will be terminated by divine judgment. And that's what's going to happen. We read last week how Antichrist would go down eventually. And so, too, here it says, he shall be broken, verse 25 at the end. He will be broken without hand, which says, kind of tells us without person killing him, or it'll be God's hand. It won't be human. It'll be God taking him out, just like it's going to happen in the Great Tribulation. Now you say, okay, Brett, wow, a lot of stuff about Antiochus Epiphanes, the Medes and the Persians, the Alexander, all that stuff. But what does this have to do with me? Well, that brings us to the final verse. As for me, Daniel, I fainted, verse 27, and was sick certain days. Afterward, I rose up and did the king's business. And I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. Well, see, Brett, right there, I'm one of those prophecy guys that says, I don't understand it, you don't understand it, so who cares? God's coming back someday, we're just going to... Well, wait, no one will understand it. Well, Daniel 12 tells us that he was to seal up the words of his book until the time of the end. And knowledge shall increase. We'll start to understand what's going on in the Bible as we get closer to those days. And I believe Daniel chapter 7 tells us of not only a historic period, but it foreshadows a future ruler that's going to come in the person of Antichrist, this world leader that's going to come out of 10 nations, out of what is the old Roman Empire. That's this place of the world we're talking about tonight. When we watch the news, I have to admit, I watch it with interest as I see these different nations surrounding the old Roman Empire, basically around the Mediterranean Sea, all those nations around there in parts of Africa, Israel, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. As you go up into the north and you start looking in some of these other nations, what ruler is going to surface out of those nations? And I don't believe it's wise to name, oh, I think this guy is going to be the Antichrist. But boy, there's a bunch of guys on the scene that I could go, that really could be. That guy could be. Boy, look at that guy. And you look at these different rulers that kind of come and go, and it's just kind of fun to speculate, but that's all it is, speculation. Why? 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 tells us that he won't be revealed until there be a taking away first. What's going to be taken away? The church. See, before all this stuff happens, before Antichrist is revealed, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 tells us that we're going to be taken up out of here. That's the rapture of the church. That's going to be a great time. So what do I do with this, Brett? Well, as I told you at the beginning of our study, Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. We should look to Jesus Christ and do his business as Daniel did. He rose up afterward and he did the king's business. What business has the king given for you to do? See, the thing I love about Daniel, why he's astonished and sick and falling flat on his face and going, wow, what have I seen? He gets up, dusts himself off, and gets busy and goes and does the work of the king. In the same way, I think you and I are called to do the king's business. And when I read about these future prophecies that are coming, and when I see the Bible, wow, Daniel, by the power of God, predicting future events, as he will predict future events for us as well. Man, this is not a time for us to just say, well, we'll just see if all this happens. And, well, we'll just see what happens in the end times and all this stuff about Israel. Oh, it's not a time to be sleepy, but it's a time to be sober and vigilant and going about the king's business. And maybe for you, the king's business is to share the love of Jesus Christ with those who have no clue about this. You see, the reason the Lord repetitiously has us go over this is it's just kind of dumb if you're there at the gym and somebody's saying, man, what do you think about all this stuff that's going on in Israel? Well, man, you see, there's the Medes and the Persians and a horn that gets knocked off and then another horn comes and honks and, whoa, it's just amazing. And Daniel and Revelation, yeah. And the person looks at you and says, huh? No, the reason we're going through this repetitiously is so you can actually kind of have a little more of a grasp and say, you know, the Bible talks about a coming leader that's going to be in the Middle East that's going to sort of seem to solve all these problems, going to come with a peace treaty. And all these things the Bible predicted, and it's why we believe the Bible. It's a true book, and it confirms itself through prophecy. And there's things you can tell people, and man, the king's business is to go into all the world and preach the gospel. So that's my challenge to you. As you've looked at this thing, man, Brett, there's not a lot of application for me personally tonight. And I'd say, no, there is. Do what Daniel does. Follow his lead and get about the king's business tonight. Amen?